Remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's CEDNR call on Tuesday, the 18th of May. We have Alan Greenberg, Tatiana Kramsova, Steve Mutasami, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Michaela Nalon, Ron Wickersham, James Bladel, Barry Cobb, Paul Diaz, Jeffrey Eckhouse, Mason Cole, Ted Suzuki, Mikey O'Connor. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Margie Milam, myself, Gisela Gruber-White. I hope I haven't forgotten anyone and I haven't got any apologies noted. Please just state your names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much. Over to you, Alan.
Thank you, Gisela. All right. Today, I think we're going to try to do one final pass of the survey so that we can get that out in the next day or so. And it's looking pretty good. We're having some birth pains with the survey tool, but other than that, I think it's getting close. There have been a number of changes in the last week or so, and I'd like to review them now. The only other thing on our agenda is to talk about the report, and we've gotten some comments in, and hopefully we will get significant others in the next N days, and we'll talk about what N is. And we also need to talk a little bit about preparation for the session in Brussels. All right. If you want to scroll down, the changes are highlighted in the report that was sent out. I sent it out late last night, so everyone should have gotten a copy. Okay. The first substantive one is in question number two. And at the last meeting, we decided to do away with the specific day ranges and to put a more global one of less than 29 days, 30 to 39, and 40 plus. We use slightly different numbers, but they overlapped. So I somewhat arbitrarily picked these. This is in line with the actual numbers that show up in the survey we did of registrars, in that there was none of the registrars we looked at that provided less than 30 days. Some had 35, and the largest number was 40. Any problems with what we have here, or do we go with what we have? And again, as we agreed, we're asking this basically the same question as, should it be part of policy? That is, all registrars are required to do it, which implies we already know the good guys are doing it. The question is, do we require that everyone do it, or do we just say there is no policy, but perhaps there's some sort of best practice? In the absence of hands, I'll assume that this is acceptable to all. Chance for people to yell out if they're not on the Adobe room. No? Okay. All right.
Ron's hands up.
Yes, Ron, go ahead. Sorry, thank you.
Sorry. One thing, after considering all of the various dates, I'm wondering if there could be agreement to select a smaller number of days. I'm troubled by the fact that in this provision, we may say, in one you may say 29 days, and another one you say 1 month. Another one says 30 days. We in the preamble or the issue part of this, we point out that 45 days is the EDDP thing that had reached a consensus. So, for the purpose of making everything clearer, I'm persuaded that it would be good to have 45 days for almost everything, because they're all kind of equally important. It's important to renew. It's important to have the grace periods, et cetera. So that's just a comment, not really a request to revise the...
Well, I mean, I would certainly support that. You know, I'd support any number that's big. The question was, do we want to require that as an absolute minimum for every registrar and allow some level of differentiation between registrars, or do we believe that it really must be the full AGRP time? James?
Yeah, really quickly, Ron. I just want to point out that reason we say 40, and I think GoDaddy says 42 or 43, is because of the 45-day ARGP. We want to allow ourselves one or two extra days for communication, coordination, method of payment, clearance, and all just the little things that could accumulate into an extra day or two and push you over that time frame. So I think that's why we say something like 40 to 43 days, which gives us a couple of extra days margin of error. The second point was just more along the lines of, when we talk about requiring these types of minimums, when they involve the ARJP, we're essentially mandating that some registrars who don't currently offer or don't currently subscribe to the ARGP, we're telling them how they must manage their finances. I think that shouldn't be undertaken casually. We really need to think about what the downstream implications of that recommendation would be.
Just for clarity, the ADDP allows a registrar to delete the name early, and that was addressed. That issue was addressed in the change that was done into the issue description. So,
okay,
none of this precludes a registrar from deleting it at day one.
Okay, thank you.
We need to address the problem of how does a registrant handle that, but we're not putting the onus on the registrar to bear that cost. Jeff?
Maybe, Alan, could you explain? I was a little confused. Now I thought you cleared it up. Now I'm even more confused.
Okay.
You saw it. Because now I was with James's point, and I agree with him, and then you clarified it, but then I don't see how it does that. So maybe can we step back and just do a quick, could you do a quick walkthrough of it? Because I like what you're saying, but I don't see it. So maybe if you could clarify
there's it. There's a paragraph that's in red just before options.
Right.
And it says, when we do the actual final, we're not trying to craft the words in the RAA here, but it says, when we craft those words, we have to recognize that there are registrants who are allowed, that registrars are allowed to do a delete early. And the words, and the crafting should remember that.
Okay. And let me just take a quick read. So, it should say it should consider the ability of a registrar. Is it worth going through this? I'm just thinking, does it have teeth if we have that? Because then, I don't know. Give me a second to just read through this again, because now I think I got a little clarification on it. Oh, you guys shouldn't wait for me. Keep going on this.
Okay. let me address a little bit. The reason I didn't try to put very specific words there, partly because we're not really at the crafting a policy stage, and partly it's dependent on how other things go. If we decide, for instance, that the RGP is not mandatory, then allowing a registrar to delete the name day one essentially says that name is absolutely gone. Because if they delete it and they don't offer an RGP and we don't allow a transfer under an RGP, the registrant has no options left. So some of these things are, to use the words that have been used in other policies, a tapestry, that they're somewhat linked together. And when and if we're crafting policy, we have to actually look at it as the whole package, not just one by one. All right, in the absence of Jeff, if you want to come back in on that one, we can go back.
Yeah, thanks, I might. Thank you, though, for that option.
All right, the next one, let me try to remember what was done here. Okay. This is the change that was suggested in the last meeting on the issue of sending notices. That is, any policy change should consider giving a registrant the ability to explicitly opt out of notices and to conditions such as deletion of the name that remove the need for notices. So essentially, we're not saying blindly send out notices if there's a situation where clearly they are not needed. And there was no other change in that one in intent. All right, and question for Jeff.
Yeah, sorry, just a quick one on this. So do we, maybe I'm just still confused, but on this one then, wouldn't we need to change the EDDP then? Any policy change would also have to change, would have to flow through everything else and give the second notice, however that's clarified, all those things, and says, unless registrant explicitly opts out of notices. Am I correct on that? Wouldn't we have to flow through that? And I think that would leave sort of less protections, but that's just my personal opinion. But wouldn't we have to flow through back to all the other old policy on that?
Oh, I think any of these things, in the original versions, we have, well, actually this one still has revised. It says revise section 3.7.5 or elsewhere. I think the RAA has to be considered as a whole, regardless of whether it's associated with the EDDP change or some of the base code in it. So I agree with you that the concept of opting out is going to have to be carefully crafted. So that's why in this document, I capitalized explicitly, just so it's got to be something. But I think the point was made, perhaps by James, I'm not sure, that there are, or may have been you, that there are situations where, for one reason or another, a registrant says, I do not want these 45 notices. And certainly the prior deletion is one of those, but there may be others. I'm not wedded to giving this exemption. It was requested by somebody. James? Yeah, James?
Yeah, I think that I think Jeff made some good points. I think I also have some concerns about this as well, and I don't think it was me that raised this exemption. I think I pointed out some examples where folks get frustrated because we don't allow them to opt out, but I don't feel that we should give them that ability, especially for these non-promotional, urgent messages that affect their registration.
Okay, so the opt out is gone. We'll still have some words there which make it clear that, an explicit deletion request or something like that means you don't have to send redundant notices.
Hang on, I think that McKelly had a point there or something. I just wanted to say it wasn't me that raised it. I'm not saying that the person.
No, well, unless I'm hearing other words, I added it from a point of goodwill. Is there anyone who feels we need the explicit opt-out? Remember, we're not crafting the policy here. We still have an opportunity to look at options like that. But if no one really feels it's desirable, there's no point in committing to it right now. Jeff, are you...
Oh no! It was up from before, but I don't think it's needed. But that's just an opinion. But
then let's take it out of the survey, and we still have the option when we get to the point of actually looking at detailed wording, if we feel it's necessary. All right. Okay, question four is the notice periods, that is, when do notices get sent? I originally had some windows. They were generally people like the concept of a specific time and some leeway around it. And I think what we ended up with last time is a notice should be sent at the 1 month and 1 week period with leeway around both the 1 month, leeway around the 1 month of a week and leeway around the 1 week of 3 days. That gives at least 4 business days before expiration that notice can be sent. which essentially says there's a notice that is not too early and one that is not too late. Anything above that is fine. Michele?
I'd just be careful about using the term business days. I think you said business days or working days just now. Just be careful with that one. It should just be days.
I believe it is day, it is currently days, which presumably means calendar days.
You know, you just said it.
If I said business days, I didn't mean to. I retract. But I don't think the document says days. The only time we have days mentioned is under the 3 days, and I would say 3 calendar days there. That should be explicit. Otherwise, 3 business days could extend to be 5 or 6 days, depending on which week it is. Anything else on this question? Going once, twice. Okay, 5 was the ugly one, where we had things ranging from substantive changes to Twitters. And I made a minor change in the preamble because I didn't quite know what facilitate information was. I think we meant information exchange or something. So I put communications as something that parsed slightly better. The new sentence at the beginning of issue came up in the review we did just prior to the last meeting. That is, it became obvious that the current RIA and EDDP do not say anything about methods of how this notification should be sent. You know, whether it can range from something being emailed, this seems to be the default one that people expect. On the other hand, it could well be carrier pigeon. And I have added a question in the options that reflect that. So essentially, I've asked the first option: should the RAA specify a specific means of communication? And if so, the person filling in the survey should specify what that is. Should it state clearly what methods will be used? Which says it's the option of the registrar, but they have to tell you ahead of time. Most of the next ones were there. I did enlarge the words on the issue of what email address to use, just to make it clear what we're talking about. I hope my parenthetical of if domain.tld has expired, at least one of the contact addresses must not be user@domain.tld. That's not clear. Let me know. I've removed SMS and Twitter on the recommendations of everyone. And I think the rest of them were basically the same. I took out the hosting context. I didn't know what that meant. If someone can explain what it meant, I'll be glad to put it back. But as it was worded, I wasn't quite sure. Jeff?
Sorry, I just muted myself. I was looking, include a hosting contact. I don't know about that one, but what I do have a question on is, should only accept Whois data that includes at least one contact used for other than the domain in question? This is one that I don't know how you would enforce or how to put in. You could tell someone, you could have a note that says on your form, you could say, please use an alternate email address, but should only means that, you know, what we're saying here is that the RAA should be amended to do that. And if somebody puts something else in, then you're saying, okay, I need to, then they're out of compliance. And I don't know if registrars can even check that and validate it, and two, if that's going to be useful, if it's going to, you know, you're asking, it's a huge change, and I don't even know if it could be done, but then a lot of people will be kicked out,
we'll be out of compliance for it because registrants might not enter in another email address. I mean, you could say, hey, please enter another email address, but as a suggestion, but I mean, we have an alternate one at Enom. We let you all enter in two, but I think that's a major, major change that we should not just think about lightly or even suggest that, hey, if this group thinks it's a good idea, we should implement it, because that is a major, major change for how things work.
Okay, I have a comment on that, but let's go through the queue. Mikey?
You know, mine was about hosting, and I think it was just hosting provider contact was what might have been stuck
so
in there.
You're saying if the registrar knows about a hosting contact, or?
Yeah, I was just going to suggest that when you were wondering who the hosting contact was, I think it's hosting provider contact. That's all. I tend to agree with Jeff on the notion that forcing registrants to register their email outside of the domain does strike me as tricky.
I'm not sure why it's tricky. I could probably give you an argument why it's not a good idea, just as I can why it is a good idea. I'm not sure why it's tricky. If you know you're handling the Whois data for alangreenberg.com,
but, you know, let's say it's Thomson Reuters, you know,
okay,
the gang I hang out with a lot. You know, you're basically saying to Thomson, do everything in the galaxy under Thomson.com except manage Whois. It's tricky. You know, I mean, a data center ops guy would sort of go, huh? What are you talking about? That's all.
With the result that if the domain expires, the email, any post-expiration reminders to that domain don't
right.
get delivered.
Which is part of the reason we've had all these conversations about, A, alternate notification,
right,
and, B, having all the services fall down so that people get reminded really fast.
Yeah. Okay, James?
Hey, Alan, it's Jeff. Can I just follow up one point? And just
sure.
Maybe I wasn't clear about how it's tricky. Let's just say, I'll give you an example. Usually this is the easiest way to clear it up. Let's say I want to get my mom online, and say she says, okay, I want to get her domain and her email.
Right.
And what you're saying to somebody is, hey, you know what, you need to go out, get another email address from some ad-supported email company like a Hotmail or Gmail, or pay for an alternate one. Because the email address you're getting, you know, at mom.com, you know, say mom.com was available, and she gets mom.com, and, you know, she gets me at mom.com as her email address, saying, hey, you know what, you can't get online like that. You need to go to a free ad-supported service, have them read your email, display ads for it. You need to check that afterwards, because that's where your notices are going, because the email address that you're buying from this registrar isn't sufficient. And that's where it gets extremely tricky. You're telling people, hey, you can't get online unless you have another email address.
Understood. Michele? Ron next? James is next, I think.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say I agree with Jeff, and I thought that we had discussed either here or elsewhere in the survey the idea that this would not necessarily be a requirement for registrars to filter this data and verify that the email address was different, but that we were going to include some language or some cautionary statement in the WDRP, the Whois Data Reminder Policy, messages that were sent out that, you know, if you choose to have these self-referencing domain names, that you could run the risk of losing important notifications and losing your registration. So I thought that, you know, that was kind of what we were driving at with this option. But I have to call this
model. I think that is covered somewhere else also.
In that case, I would ask that maybe we could reinforce it here.
Okay. Ron?
Yes. With regard to the billing contact along with the registrant, my impression was that all contacts were to be notified. So I may be wrong there, but in some registrars, where I'm the technical contact, I get notified, and
often this is good because, you know, since I'm handling the DNS issues, I should be aware that the domain may potentially expire, as well as I usually know who to contact to really get it renewed.
I believe, but there's other people coming up to talk who can tell give us a better thing, that the RAE is not explicit on who must be notified. I know some people notify everybody and their cousin. I'm not sure there is any specificity of saying, should it be the billing contact, should it be the admin, should it be the technical. But if we can go on to the next people, maybe they can enlighten us. Was there anything else wrong?
That's all, yeah.
Okay, Michele?
Yeah. Okay, there's two things here. One is that mandating this kind of change by the RAA is a very bad idea. Both James and Jeff have pretty much said what I would have said. I mean, the simple thing is you can suggest, reiterate, emphasize, warn, give people multiple warnings, explain to them the reasons why they should do something, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is, in practice, that they, A, probably won't do it, and B, you're adding an extra level of complication. The kind of situation that we see regularly is that somebody who's never had a domain name ever in their lives, they might have a free pro-A email address from a Hotmail or a Gmail, or maybe from some ISP that they had a dial-up account with at some point. They go off and they register a domain, be that a .com or in a ccTLD. They get an email service, and they start using that, and they stop using the free email. And in many cases, with Hotmail and all the other services, they actually close down accounts or render access to them pretty impossible if they're not logged into for a period of time. So, for example, Jeff gave the example of his mother. I mean, I would have used the example of my own mother, who's probably about of roughly the same vintage as Jeff's. To ask my mother to maintain a second email account just on the off chance that her primary one would cease functioning because the domain had expired is unreasonable, and it wouldn't actually work. Whereas suggesting somewhere that people, like via the WDRP or just anywhere else, that they make sure that the contact points are kept up to date and all these kind of things is the only sane way to do it.
Or offer your mother that the email be sent to you.
Well, in the case of my mother's domain, Alan, as I'm sure you'd appreciate, the woman never ever sees a bill for us. Because I may be a heartless capitalist swine. However,
but you're a good son.
Well, it's nothing about being a good son. It's just once upon a time I had a mail server that was not really reliable. My mother was the early warning system. I'm getting phone calls from your mother at 3 o'clock in the morning. Her bloody email isn't working. You make sure that it's working, and B, she doesn't get any emails about it. I can assure you.
Okay. Sure, good son.
Before we go on, I'll point out that this was one of the options. The next option is it's not required that you ensure that the address not be different, but that you issue a warning. And there's two more options later on that both of these things be done as best practices. So,
this wasn't that the RAA be amended is the problem.
Sorry?
You've got the first line saying recommends that the RAA be amended.
Yes, but then the whole set of options is repeated under B as best practice.
But I'm looking at, where's B?
Keep scrolling down.
I'm scrolling. I can't see it.
Just following the first none of the above.
Oh, right. Oh, I see what you've done. Okay. Well, then I'd obviously be looking at B. So I still think that's amended the RAA.
Remember, this is a survey to get different opinions. We're not trying to cast all the answers in. Helen.
Yes, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think this should be put in the RAA as anything other than a recommendation. We recommend, if possible, to have two email addresses. Not on the WHOIS either. It's often better to have an account that the user uses, and they can put their email address that they don't want to be shown to the public in the account. Whereas they're going to put in their Hotmail address or a rubbish email address on the WHOIS because everybody sees it and they don't want it to, and I think that's a problem. Having two valid email addresses on your domain name, do you really want to do that? Because you might be putting your good email address on it. But you encourage people, where possible, if they've got two email addresses, at least to put them on the account. And again, as I said before, people should be able to opt out of sending it so that, you know, if you're a technical contact and you don't want to get the emails, then it shouldn't be required if the registrant doesn't want it. So the way we do it, we have account emails and then we have where to send emails, and you can tick off, untick all of them so they never get reminder notices, but it can be to the following list of things and you tick them on, tick them off. And other than giving people recommendations, no, people are going to thwart the system. So all you can do is would say we recommend you have at least two email addresses, and if they decide not to do that, that is up to them. You cannot make it completely idiot-proof because people are going to do it. I don't think you should start making it difficult for the registrants either, though.
I'm trying to understand what. In this question, we are giving a whole bunch of options which people can say are good things that should be mandated or should be best practices or do nothing.
Basically, just we recommend that the following be considered. I don't understand why any of it should be mandated because there's going to be so many different cases, and you've got to leave the registrar the flexibility to follow under different circumstances. Different things come up. And trying to put it all in stone, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But you can have a list of recommendations for the idiot registrars that haven't a clue how to do it. And the ones that are more sensible can go ahead with their own system, which works.
And that, of course, is the point. But I think there are options there which you feel comfortable with, because all these options are listed as best practices also. So you can select none of the RAA changes and do it only as best practices or nothing at all and leave it all up to the registrar.
I think it should really be left to the registrars, but if it makes you feel better, it's a good idea to say we suggest the following.
Well,
be done.
We've been told that in writing the survey we shouldn't decide on what the answer is ahead of time. I'm trying to understand it. Are people really suggesting that we eliminate option A altogether from this question and not ask the question?
It's actually not a bad idea.
Okay, Jeff? Ron?
Yeah, I think my point on this and is saying, hey, let me just open to get back to this, is saying, you know, if you want to give options, let's make them options that people we can actually act upon and that are feasible options. You know, that's why Alan, I understand your point, and you're saying, hey, we're putting this in a survey for people to answer, and they need to, let's see what it is. But I wouldn't want to put that in, and then suddenly, you know, there are people in this group who may not be following, who may not understand, and they put forward, and they say, okay, let's do it, and then suddenly it's like, there's a consensus or a majority that this should be an option, and then we have to go through this again. I don't think it's an actual option, so that's why I think we should take it out as something that it would be in the RAA versus something that we could say we recommend that the registrar or whoever it is take another email address, an additional email address, which, as I said, I'm fine with that. I think a lot of us already do that, but as a recommendation and best practice versus it's required in the RAA that they do that.
Any non-registrars want to have a say on this?
I do. I'll just say
something. Cheryl and Mikey.
I'll just say something. It does concern me a little bit here. I definitely hear what everybody's saying, and I'm thinking back to dim dark days when, you know, I was picking up for the very first time some various domain names, and you didn't have an email into, you know, I am that old, I do remember. You did tend to put in an alternate, one of those freebie email addresses, and one of the motivators that you, well, certainly I used for friends of mine as we were trying to encourage this whole concept of it would be a good idea for you to get a website for your small and micro business, and therefore you should get a domain name to do that, was to give to get away from those free ones, those alternate ones, and to give some sense of corporate identity and stability, which of course is why the investment in these things for people is so important as well. But by the same token, if you've bought something for 10 years, for example, in the case, I better defend mothers here for a minute. As a mother, my children have no knowledge that billing is somehow acquired or magically happens for their domain names. I remain as the billing contact. Yes, I suppose I could change it, but it just gets paid. Now, after I drop dead, they will probably be very, very surprised that their email stops working. So, you know, there are a few things. So I think the option for alternate is important. I certainly see where enshrining it in a rule as opposed to best practice could be problematic. But it may come back to this matter of educating our registrants and having some best practice and sets of expectations that registrants can fall back on, as opposed to hard and fast rules. So I'm sitting on the fence, an unusual position for me.
Mikey?
Thanks, Alan. It's Mikey. I wouldn't lose the whole Section A. I mean, that's a pretty big step. But I certainly understand Jeff's and James' point that, you know, let's consider dropping this one at least from the list of A, maybe the list of A, the RIA ones, and the list of B, best practices ones, isn't identical. Maybe the ones that go in the best practice are there partly because they would be very difficult to implement across the board in the RIA.
Okay. Ron?
Yeah, I'm concerned that, I have an historic revulsion to the term best practices from another context, not associated with ICANN. But I don't understand in the context of ICANN what best practices means. And, for instance, is compliance ever an issue with best practices, or are best practices options if you feel like it and have no weight other than that?
I think the answer to that is it depends on which best practice it is. In the case of registries, there are safe harbors that they can use if they have taken all reasonable measures, or the words are similar to that, and that translates to best practices. So they become almost required. In the case of registrars, if there are no safe harbors involved in the particular issue, then it's simply an interesting concept, unless, as some jurisdictions have done, there's a code of practice which the registrars need to sign on, and Cheryl can talk about that.
I'm going to clear my status now because that's all I was going to say. Is the working operational mood of industry-developed best practice, which is a code of practice, and that, in fact, can have some teeth in some areas. Yeah.
If the registrar's constituency comes up with best practices and a little logo which registrars want to display, then it has more teeth than not.
Yeah, Mike, that's right.
Yes. But can anyone answer my question as far as ICANN's compliance team? Do they ignore best practices or do they embrace them?
I don't think they have any involvement with it because they're looking at violations of required action. Or Mikey?
It's Mikey.
Yeah.
The best practices thing is sort of evolving in parallel on several working groups. And I think today it's safe to say, Ron, that the whole best practices thing is pretty undefined at the moment. But there's some stuff coming out of... James Paul, help me out. I can't remember if it's RAP or IT or IRTP. Anyway, there's a gaggle of references that are coming out sort of simultaneously with the thought that one of the next projects that ICANN really needs to undertake is a mechanism to capture them, let people know about them. But I, to answer your question directly, Ron, I think that's the whole point of best practices, at least at this stage, is that they aren't subject to compliance because they're not part of the contract, per se.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right. I think we've run out of a speaker's queue. The consensus I'm hearing is to, if I can try to meld them all together, is to definitely remove the requirement in Section A that registrars forbid the use of all, or that registrars require at least one of the addresses to be different from the domain in question, that we can leave it in as a best practice, and we go ahead. That comes close enough to people.
I would change the language. This is Mike again, sorry. Yeah. I would change the language so that it's not should only accept, but rather something along the lines of what Jeff and James were proposing, that strongly encourage or educate or something.
Well, there's a second point of talking about a warning. Education, I think, is covered somewhere else.
Okay.
But if you leave it to us, we'll try to we'll try to craft some words that add in the concept of that. Just make a note. Helen.
Yeah, I'm basically echoing that. I don't know why we need to use the word best practice at all. It just suggest or encourage is sufficient, I think. Just because it is impossible to do it, but suggest or encourage is perhaps a good way to put it in.
Is there a consensus in this group? I mean, we people have been recommending that we do things as best practices.
Yes, but if you make that
a best practice,
you do have to watch the terminology to best practice, and best practice might start getting more enforceable. So I would not suggest you try and eliminate a lot of registrants by saying that they have to have two email addresses. So you start saying best practices. Do we follow best practices? No, we don't follow best practices because some of our registrants only have one email. Therefore, we're not a best practice registrar and we can't have the logo. No, we recommend that they, or encourage them to accept a second email, and that's the best practice would be the mode of attempting to retrieve another email, not trying to enforce it. So I would take out the word best practice completely for that. Just recommend or encourage is.
But are you saying that we take it out everywhere we're using it, or just in this question?
Well, specifically in this one, yeah. Some places it's not a bad idea. It's definitely a good idea, a best practice for sending out the email reminder notices. I'm just not sure that you need such specifics. I still think for the email reminder notices, send in a minimum of two email notices in the month before expiration. Maybe two spaced emails is sufficient. I don't see why you have to say 1 week plus or minus 3 days and whatever. That seems seems a bit silly.
I don't think we can go back and redo everything that we've discussed at the previous meetings.
We're never going to get it. Don't word it so tightly. You're wording it. It's not necessary to have it worded so tightly.
Mikey?
This is Mikey. I think that the way to handle this is A, eliminate it from Part A. B, change it to recommend or suggest. C, put it in the best practices clump, but don't call it a best practice within the clump. Just put it in the best practices clump so that then if a registrar suggests or encourages their registrant to have another email address, they're still following best practices and they can wear the logo.
I guess I didn't understand what you mean by best practices clump.
Part B of this question.
Well,
recommendations that a best practice be documented, encouraging that registrars, colon, and then
all right,
above.
And, but I think that's what I suggested. I said
that's
it'd be removed from Section A, but kept in Section B.
I'm agreeing with you.
Okay, thanks. Sorry. I'm used to people disagreeing with me.
Trying to fake you out.
You succeeded.
Alan, if I may.
Yes, yes, please.
If you then move on from that agreement and have it removed from A and in B, changing the words to say recommending, B recommends that documentation encourage that registrars, just by removing the words best practice, you don't lose anything other than the fear that best practice is somehow going to come enforceable without it necessarily being a industry-based code of conduct. So are we agreed on also losing the two-word best and practice out of B?
If that's the general consensus, I can certainly live with this. But recommends that documentation encourage
that registrars and then same as listed above, excepting it won't be same as listed above because it won't be listed above, but you know what we mean.
That was shorthand for this.
I understand.
The actual questionnaire has actual words to stick off.
Alan, I do understand.
Okay, so...
And for those of you who were on a call yesterday, all my dogs are now in, so it could get exciting.
Okay, so in this question about methods of notification, in Section B we change the best practices to the words that Cheryl suggested. And we have one tick mark and no hands. I suggest we go on.
Quickly, before people think.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm scrolling as quickly as I can on my screen. All right, this was a point suggested at one of our last meetings, I can't remember which, and that is that a warning that if information is not up to date, you will not get renewal notices. I think that was James that suggested that was a good opportunity to get that advertisement in. No, Ron. Yes.
Yeah, I currently receive emails from at least one registrar that informs me that they are following ICANN's requirement that once a year they send me an email notice.
Yes, that's correct.
To make sure stuff is up to date. So
yeah,
how does this
so
differ?
This says when you voluntarily go in to when you either register the domain for the first time or when you go in to renew it, not post-expiration necessarily, that it just remind you.
Mm-hmm.
Michele?
Yeah, just to address Ron's point, the problem, Ron, would be if you registered a domain name and you didn't provide proper contact details when you were doing it, then there's no way for any registrar to send you the Whois data reminder because you wouldn't have given us the correct contact information in the first instance.
Yeah, I think the issue is if you don't have a large portfolio and you don't daily log on to your registrar, you, in fact, have very little contact with them. This is one of the very few times that you may go into your registrar's site and do something.
Well, I mean, the thing is that the idea was to, that I understand it would be to make it very clear to people at the time that they actually initiate the service, that they register the domain name, that you make it clear to them that if they don't keep their details up to date, they may not get notifications and they may end up losing the domain. Whereas the WDRP thing, it should get sent out to the Whois records it should get sent out automatically regardless of the registrar, but of course it won't get to the correct person if that person hasn't kept their contact details up to date and hasn't realized that they need to keep it up to date.
The idea was to
deal with the root cause of the issue before it became an issue.
At one of the few windows that one has when there is an interaction between registrars and registrants.
Yeah, basically.
All right, post-expiration. We are now in... We've taken out a number of the questions that... I've tried to use in the survey, understanding that although we go into great depth in the report of defining the auto-renew grace period and warning period that is not as the same as the auto-renew period, which many registrars have. I think in the survey, I was trying to avoid the use of the term auto-renew grace period. And so I tried to craft some words that define the time period between expiration and deletion. With it without using those words, and I don't know to what extent I've succeeded, but currently I have the words to indicate that once a domain name registration passes its expiration date, it is clear that it has expired. If someone has better words, I'm willing to take them, but I couldn't figure out what they were. Ron?
Yes. I have a suggested change in the preamble, second paragraph. There was strong support for implementing the additional measures to reduce the possibility that an RAE is unaware of the expiration, and I would recommend changing that the expired status is communicated clearly to the registrant. Put it, it's kind of just reversing it around, but rather than saying unaware of the expiration.
Well, how about increase the possibility that the RAE is aware of the expiration?
Good. Yeah.
Because I don't want to rely purely on formal communication.
Right. Okay. No. I like your suggestion very well. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, done. And I don't think there were any substantive changes there. In question 9, under options, following an extensive discussion over the last couple of weeks, talking about encryption, which we decided was not possible for technical reasons, but subdomains, which is, and in fact most registrars already catch all subdomains, because in fact for a monetized domain you definitely want to catch them all, that we simply put that in the document. And I've left the word in the detailed questions of several days, but noting that at policy writing time, it will have to be made more explicit what is meant. Any questions? Ron, is your hand up from before or this one?
For currently, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
On the question 9 issue, it says the second sentence, query sent to URL with an expired domain, would it make it more make it better by saying sent to a URL within a recently expired domain rather than discussing it about a domain that expired 2 years ago?
Currently, there's no guidance what happens. I have no problem with recently expired, although I don't think it's within the, excuse the pun, domain of a registrar to worry about what happens with a domain that is dead and gone many years ago, but recently expired, I have no problem with.
It sort of indicates it might be resuscitatable, doesn't it?
Well, that's the whole concept.
I'm thinking about people being able to put do not resuscitate or do not renew orders on their domain names just to make this easier in the future.
Well, I think we actually covered that in an earlier one, but I like the idea of bringing things back to life here. Imbues the power of gods in us all. Okay. Any other issues on questions?
The elevation. I've brought people back to life before.
Any other questions on number 9? Going, gone. 10. I don't think there were any I don't believe there were any changes other than, the clarity of several days. And 10 is the rest of the ports, and I think it's no changes there at all. 12 is brand new. This is the issue of transfer post-expiration. And we had a long discussion last time on the wording of it. And I had erred when I worded the comment on it on email talking about the registrant requesting the transfer of the losing registrar. And I was... That was my fault. I was mislaid by, misdirected by the term requested in the various ICANN policies and compliance notices. And in fact, they did use the word request, but it was not the registrant requesting of the losing registrar, but the registry requesting of the losing registrar. So I have reworded this to identify the real problem, that is, a registrant is not able to request a transfer from the gaining registrar because of a number of problems associated with the registrar of record. That is, the who is says they're not the registrant anymore, so the registry and the gaining registrar have no way of knowing that this is in fact the old registrant, or they can't obtain an auth code, or the domain is locked, and the losing registrar will not respond to the request for that reason. Now, the issues associated with this are really complex, and getting the words right are not necessarily going to be easy, but the concept is, should a registrant be able to not exercise their right to transfer because the registrar essentially is stonewalling them in one way or another? And the question asking here is, should there be the right to do it, the ability to do it? Actually enacting that is going to be, the wording is going to be hard. Mikey?
This is Mikey. I think you could drop this one. This is basically right spang in the middle of the IRTP series of working groups. And
but it's not one that the IRTP is covering, I don't believe.
Yeah, we are. We are chugging our way through a whole series of issues. We're not covering it right now, but we've got two more jars full on our plate.
Yeah, I thought that this was addressed in A. And wasn't really addressed. I may be wrong on that.
I can't. Maybe James chimed in with the same thought. So James, if you can remember which one we're tackling this, but
I hadn't heard that anyone is looking at this one.
My comment was actually on a different topic, Mikey. But
okay. Well,
nothing jumps out at me. I'd have to take a look at the series of IRTP meeting charters to see where this one fits.
I mean, again, us asking the question doesn't commit us to write policy. The question really asking is, should the hole be plugged? James? Is your hand still up or new up? I've lost.
No, this is the actual topic I wanted to comment on, and I realize you've moved on beyond this, but
we can go back. We still have time.
Well, Ron had an earlier comment about the recently expired, and then we were just kind of kicking around. There's a thread there in the chat window about recently expired but recoverable, I think is how we wanted to describe that. And I'm trying to find the context here. I think it was in the previous question, which would have been...
Okay. So really we're talking about during the ARGP, which a word we're trying not to use, but we're talking about during the 45-day ARGP period.
Yeah.
Okay. I will try to find some words that make some sense, without leaving a discretionary what recent means.
Well, we all like recent something that indicates it's still recoverable.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that encompasses a lot of things. It encompasses whether it's an ARGP, RGP, or, you know, but it draws the line at like what Ron was saying, you know, certainly something that was deleted or expired 2 or 3 years ago was not within the scope of that.
Okay.
That would be
between the people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
We actually had consensus in the chat room. We thought it was noteworthy. That's all.
Some of us are actually keeping busy without reading the chat.
But Alan, the fact that it was consensus in the chat room was noteworthy enough for us to want to raise it to the call.
And I thank you for that.
The actual meeting had gone on 3 more questions. We were still discussing number 9.
Which explains the lack of comment I had on the next question.
3 of them are working jokes into the chat.
Dear.
And I see Debbie has joined. Welcome. Back to transfer post-expiration. Does anyone object to keeping the question in? Not that it locks us in, and it may well be something that's going to be handled by an one of the future IRTP discussions, in which case I would certainly have no problem of tossing it over the wall. I hear no objections.
Alan, this is James. Sorry.
Sure.
I think the thing that concerns me about that, I mean, I'm fine with the question the way it is, and maybe I'll just zip it for now and see what we get back as far as survey results. But I'm just concerned that we don't really go into a whole lot of detail on how a registrar must facilitate the outgoing transfer of domain post-expiration. I think that, you know, even if one were to want to respond in good faith and say, yes, this should be allowable, I think that the devil's in the details there in responding to question A. So we might see a lot of question B responses out of caution. So, but, you know, I think at this point, let's go with it as it's worded. And
I guess I'm offended at some level by, you know, words being said by ICANN that a registrant can transfer post-expiration. You know, but the fine print says, assuming you can actually get your registrar of record to behave and do what they have to do, when we know most registration agreements, for instance, allow the registrar to change who the owner is, which essentially kills the ability to transfer.
Okay, well, I guess rather than kind of imply that, I mean, let's get it out there. Let's say that, you know.
I think that's one of the options. Well, but that's not the only reason. You can do it. A registrar could do it just as effectively by, killing the ability of the registrant to go into their domain manager and do it.
Yeah. Or we could say something like, "We will send the auth info code to the same address to which you ignored all of the renewal notices."
Ooh.
Ow.
Yeah, well, you know, that could be a very useful example of an industry code of practice. That's fine. That's good.
Jeff.
She says firmly tongue-in-cheek for the record, by the way.
Yeah,
same on this end, too, by the way.
I have to step away for a sec, so I hope if this was covered, then, you know, please just stop me. But I thought one of the issues I think that I know that some of the smaller registrars I know that I've spoken to and some others have stated that they know it's the ICANN rule, and they know that, but when it comes to the who is and the other piece, what they're stating is that since I'm the one paying for this domain after the registrant had signed up for, let's call it a year term. They paid me for that year. It auto-renews. I've paid for it. Granted, I know I can get the money. You know, they could get the money back, but their argument is that I've paid for the domain, so that's I'm the registered name holder, so my name goes into the who is. I know that's been an argument, and so I think maybe James had said it, that it would be good if there was some clarification about how that whole process works. And, you know, I'm not, you know, involved in the IRTP, so I don't know if that's being discussed or if it's been cleared up in the past, but maybe it has been, maybe it needs to be done again. But I think that's where the sort of confusion goes on why the who is changed and why registrars, some of them do change the who is. There are other reasons, but that's why some of them
We're not debating whether they should or not. That's, as far as I'm concerned, not the issue. It's just that according to the ICANN policy, a registrant does have the ability to request a transfer at that time.
Oh, yeah,
I agree. And the fact that a registrar changed who is, for whatever the reasons are, should not be an inhibitor to that.
Right. It should not. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. Just what you said is fine, but just a clarification. That should be what's put out there, exactly what you had said.
Put it in the preamble to the question.
Exactly. That was, Alan, what you said was clear, and that makes a difference into that survey, that question. What Charlotte said, if you put that in, I think that would help a lot.
Okay. Marika and I will reword it, and we'll send that one out specifically to say, has this fixed the problem? Because I thought I had already said that, but I obviously didn't say it clear enough, and maybe I wrote it too late at night. All right. So we will tick the wording contract. The next one is what is now number 13. All right, there was a placeholder here which I had asked for words from registrars to echo the words that you had used in a number of calls on the difficulty of clarity and simple language in registration agreements at the same time as providing the legal document you need to cover yourselves. And I'm not trying to use dainty language. I didn't get any responses from the registrars who had made that position, and so I tried to word something myself without claiming it's the right wording, but I really would like from registrars to know how to say this in a way that's more delicate. Siva, you had your hand up? Siva, go ahead. Is there anyone else who has any comment or any wisdom to impart on this one?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
We can now.
Okay. This is one area where at large can get involved on behalf of registrants. And the assumption is that most registrants do not understand the contractual obligations that they enter into. So it is necessary for an organization like at large or NCUC to engage lawyers on behalf of registrants and come up with a contract, a model contract, which it will negotiate with registrars and arrive at a minimum set of contractual conditions.
I think if the group does that, it will be looked at. Mikey?
Well, I had another point, but let me respond to Siva's. We trod pretty the end of that in the Registration Abuse Policies Working Group, and what I was going to suggest is that at one point what we were going to do is encourage people to go ahead and write the contracts they need, but then offer a sort of shorthand version that referred to the original contract but sort of sketched out the high points. Did we capture that notion somewhere in the survey, or did that sort of...
I don't think we actually...
thing get dropped, because if it got dropped, maybe that's something we could add here. You know, I've started bonking into these now that I've run into this issue, and there seems to be a fair number of places where there's a really dense contract, and then a summary which is not legally binding but tells you the highlights.
We did not cover it very well. The recommendations talk about registration agreement and related materials. Perhaps we need more clarity there.
Alan, if you'd allow me.
Yes, please.
I think Mikey made a reference. Now, whether it was in this working group or another one, I honestly don't know, because I spend most of my ICANN working group time on the phone with Mikey there somewhere in the background. And a couple of others. So it's all great, one great big wash, a wash of PVP, WGs, and other stupid acronyms. I think Mikey made a reference on a call, and as I say, I have absolutely no idea which bloody working group it was in, whether it was this one or another one, to, I think it was thinkgeek.com.
Yeah.
And what Mikey was getting at was that, you know, he recognized, and obviously he can disagree with me if my summary of what his thoughts were is incorrect, that registrars, and like any other service provider, have to write and provide contracts that are legally binding and that are written using the kind of language that will stand up in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
That it may not be possible for the average Joe in the street to understand every single nuance within a contract isn't really our, as the service provider's fault. We can't really work around that because legal systems don't work that way. What he was talking about was the idea that you would have your normal legal thing there, and you would have just a very kind of simple, look, we're not going to screw you over type statement at the top, just kind of summarizing, you know, you're paying us for this, we're going to do this, we're going to do our best to do that, and here's the actual legal document below. I think that's what he was talking about.
Right.
Mikey,
and
please.
In fact, after you reminded me of it, Michele, I was able to find the email that I sent. I actually sent it to the Pedner list, so I just resent it to the list
right.
As an example. And that's exactly what I was thinking.
Would we address the problem in the context of this question by adding, dividing both A and B into two parts, that is the registration agreement and then explanatory material?
Possibly. I mean, the thing, I suppose, Alan, is that, look, with a lot of the registrars, and various parts on their websites, they're going to provide FAQs, knowledge bases, and various other things where they're providing information that addresses the kind of questions that they're being asked. Because it's a hell of a lot more efficient and cost-effective to provide the information on your website than to have 50 phone calls a day. Being really blunt about it. So the thing, I suppose, is it's not
that
you shouldn't be trying to...
And I'll be blunt, that's for registrars that actually publish a phone number.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. but I'll counter that by saying, for those of us who do, you know, making us jump through hoops and suffer migraines when we come off working group phone calls isn't helpful either. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, for a lot of the more problematic registrars, that were out there are no longer out there. If you look at the figures that have been produced by ICANN Compliance, so the number of registrars that have lost their accreditation in the last 18 months is more than lost their accreditation in the previous 5 years. So, I mean, the number of registrars is actually going down. But I think what Mikey was talking about is, I mean, how it is addressed in this or not, I'm not too sure. But I think what he was getting at wasn't abhorrent anyway.
But I was objecting to it. But I think he's right that we did talk about it, but we didn't capture it as a separate option, and I think we should.
Okay.
And I think that will generally address it. All right. Next one is again a new one. That is, I realized as we were talking that we talked about a question of should it be easy to find the fee, but we didn't explicitly have a requirement that the fee be publicized. And this is the counterpart to the EDDP requirement that the RGP fee be stated. And this one, it says, should the recovery fee post-expiration be stated? Hope there is no objection to asking that question. It's almost implied by the next one of saying how do we find the number, which I don't think there had been any discussion over at our last go through. Not seeing any hands. I will. The RGP. I don't believe there was any change other than. There was a discussion last time on do we need to have an exception for some TLDs for the RGP, and it was pointed out that if it's one where the situation doesn't come up, should it ever come up, manual processing could allow with an appropriate fee. Therefore, it's not clear we really need an exception, but it was left in. If the policies do not allow deletion of the name without explicit approval of the RAE. In other words, assuming the RAE has a say in this, then they must implement the RGP. I think that covered what we discussed last time. And the next question of, is it mandatory for registrars? That hasn't changed from the previous one. And lastly, a transfer during RGP. And as I was trying to word this in light of what we discussed at the last meeting, the question came up of do we need to address the case where a registrar does not post the RGP fee, which is a compliance issue, but doesn't address what the registrant at the time, how the registrant handles it. Any thoughts? Essentially, we're saying that a registrar is not in compliance with the ICANN policy. They have not posted the RGP fee. When the registrant asks, they're told our fee is $1,000. So they're not in compliance. ICANN could take action should they choose, but that doesn't address the registrant who has a domain they're trying to recover and is being held hostage at that point. James.
I'm trying to kind of wrap my mind around the scenario that you presented, but in the general case, I think that, we should be making recommendations or framing language that we feel that ICANN compliance can enforce, and then from there, the actual enforcement thereof, or if there are any gaps in their enforcement, I think it's really a separate issue.
But is there any methodology by which ICANN compliance can take action at that point, other than to slap the registrar on the wrist? McKaylee? Is
Is Michele there? Are you muted?
Oh, sorry. So, no, I'm here. Sorry. With regard to the what compliance can do, I mean, you know, if compliance starts to receive a large number of complaints about a particular registrar's activities, they could lose their accreditation. They could have their accreditation terminated for a number of reasons. I mean, it's not exactly something that they'd want. The question I had was, I was just trying to get a clarification from you about this scenario, because I followed it to a point, and then you lost me somewhere.
Okay.
You're talking about the registrar not posting the fee, and then you talk about something else, and that's where I got a bit confused. Sorry.
Okay. The EDDP requires that if the registrar offers the RGP, that the fee be posted on their website. You know, assuming it's a registrar that has a website. You know, that's one of the clearly posted requirements in the RAA now.
Okay, that's only in the 2009 RAA, Alan. So if you're seeing a problem, it could be with somebody who hasn't renewed. Yeah.
No. I understand that. I'm not talking about a specific case.
Okay.
We know that there have been a large number of registrars who were not in compliance, and presumably most of those registrars will be in compliance soon. The question is, if a situation arises where a registrar is not in compliance, and when the registrant attempts to do an RGP recovery, they are given a huge unreasonable fee from their point of view, the fact that it wasn't posted ahead of time means the registrar is not in compliance, and the compliance department can take action should they choose. But
that's not actually entirely true, Alan, because the thing about the fees was only an advisory issue in the last few months. So if the domain was registered 5 years ago and the fee wasn't posted at the time of registration 5 years ago, then they were compliant at the time of registration.
No, but I'm talking if it's not posted today.
Oh, okay.
I'm not trying to get people on a technicality or on the change of RAAs. The actual requirement came in the EDDP, so it was a consensus policy and binding on all registrars, in fact.
Yeah.
But yes, it wasn't binding in 2002, and if I had a 10-year domain before that, it didn't apply, or 2004. I'm not trying to bring up a technicality issue. The issue is a registrant can be in a position where their registrar of record does not have it posted, a compliance issue, admittedly, but compliance doesn't have the power to lower the fee because of that.
No, they wouldn't have the power to lower the fee. No, you're correct in that regard.
And the question is, should we be looking at this fee? Is it a tail end one, or is it something that a protection we need to offer? That was the question I was asking.
Well, in terms of the fee, I would say you can't really look at the fee specifically. As in that, because that would get you into that wonderfully painful scenario where none of the registrars can talk to each other.
I understand.
And the other thing is that if what might be seen as unreasonable by one person might actually not be unreasonable at all. Because unreasonable as a term is very ambiguous. So, for example, a registrant may consider $100 to be completely unreasonable, whereas quite a few registrars would probably charge something in and around that fee.
Oh, and some big ones charge $160. We're not. I don't think we're trying to quibble over the.
No, but the thing is, if you're saying unreasonable, where do you draw the line? I think it's more of a compliance issue with regards to getting them to comply in terms of publishing the fees. But look, I'll let James talk, because I'm sure he's got some more interesting insights.
James?
Actually, I'm going to disagree with Michele on one brief point here, which is that We occasionally update our registration agreement, and I think that we make notice in there that it is the registrant's responsibility to make sure that they are familiar with the most current version. I think that if we got into a situation where registrants were covered under the agreement version that was in force at the time they registered the name, I think that that would be a logistical nightmare to track exactly what was going on when.
Nor do I think anyone's suggesting that.
Yeah, well, I think McKelly said something about, you know, what was whether or not something was part of the agreement when the name was registered versus at the current time. But, you know, getting back to the original point, Alan, you know, I think that the analog here is that we as a city council or whatever have decided that we want no speeding to occur in school zones, so we create a speed limit law and we put a police officer out there. You know, and I think that we're now saying, what else could we be doing to ensure, because speeding is still happening. And I think the answer is, well, we've done what we are limited to doing, which is we've created this policy, we've given it to ICANN compliance to enforce with their policies and procedures. The fact that it's still happening or the harms are still occurring, you know, I think if there are gaps or inconsistent application of compliance procedures, then that's something a different issue entirely, and not something that needs to be written into
the
policy.
So you're saying we can set speed limits, but occasionally someone's going to die anyway.
Well,
and there are casualties because you can't. Okay, I'm willing to accept that. I raised the issue because it came up in the discussion when we were talking about this. But
what I'm saying is that at a certain point you give ICANN compliance the tools and the procedures that it needs and the policies that it can, you know, push off on to enforce. And then, you know, we kind of have to see what comes out of that. As McKelly was saying, what's reasonable to one person is unreasonable to another, and I think that, you know, that's a genuine concern. But, you know, I really am uncomfortable with this idea that, you know, what do we do if ICANN compliance is not an effective remedy? And I think the answer is, we kind of have to believe that they always will be.
Well, I guess the question I was asking was different here, because compliance cannot fix the specific case for the registrant at that point. All they can do is try to make sure it doesn't happen in the future. And I was asking, do we need to have some other escape hatch? And I think what you're saying, and perhaps McKaylee said something similar, is this is an occasional case where we're not perfect and things will break and we don't have a remedy for everyone under that. And I'm happy to live with that and just take out the whole highlighted sentence, because it was a question to this group. I wasn't suggesting wording. Ron?
Yeah, this is a slightly parallel question. If we allow the registrant to request a transfer to a new registrar, then could he shop around for a better price for the recovery?
That would be the purpose, presumably. I mean, otherwise, why not just pay the price and then transfer the day afterwards? Is anyone still here?
Yeah.
We
have to. I need to jump off the call.
Time is a killer.
Yeah, I think we're just about finished anyway. So I withdraw that whole comment on the tail end case, and you know, I accept that this may be one of the cases where an individual gets caught and it's tough. And I think we are finished other than that. And if so, we'll make the adjustments that we have talked about to the best extent we can. And Marika will get out the survey within a couple of days.
Any other comments?
Alan, if you can just have a look to some of the chat. I did put some words. You requested some words from Cheryl. I put some words in, but I'm also putting the link to the plain language contract used in the Australian telecommunications industry and coded by the government regulator as such, as an example, as a reply to Mikey's recent email on plain language. So we do have some precedent.
The chat will be captured and consulted.
Thank you.
We did not get to a further discussion on the registration agreement, on the report, nor did we talk about Brussels. That is going to have to be first thing next week. Thank you all for your endurance, and I'll see you then.
Great job, Alan. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. Thanks,
Alan.
Bye.
And Marika, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, if you don't see something in your inbox when you get in tomorrow morning, then bug the hell out of me or something. Hopefully it will get done, barring major catastrophe here.
Okay, great.
Okay,
should be able to turn it on quickly, and I can send you the link. You can preview it before I send it out to the group.
Yeah, there may be some things we need to discuss at that point, and if so, I'll highlight them carefully. But
okay.
Okay.
All right.
And Marika, I'll do a accept all revisions of the version I last sent you, and we'll start clean on this one so you can see the changes from today.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
I'll make sure you get updated.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.